Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Marcus, a recovering workaholic who transforms the chronically overworked into balanced and thriving people. I'm the author of Busting Your Corporate Idol, Self-Help for the Chronically Overworked. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, everyone, and happy Pesach to you on this Saturday morning in 2015. And you may be asking yourselves, wait a minute, we're right at the beginning of Passover. Shouldn't I be in shul? Shouldn't I be spreading butter on matzah? Shouldn't I be doing other things? But there is nothing I would rather do right at this moment but be talking to a doctor, a Jewish doctor. Really, you don't get better than that. His name is Greg Marcus, and he's not like the doctor that sticks things into you and puts things in your tuchus. No, this is a doctor of philosophy, and he has come up and has learned, or in the process of learning, a philosophy of Judaism that he thinks would be really, really helpful for people to take into their own lives, especially if, like him, you find yourself being a workaholic. You're doing this, you're doing that, you're at the job, you can't do enough for your job, and he's saying, slow down, take a moment, and use the power of Judaism to make your life better. He is Dr. Greg Marcus. He is the author of Busting Your Corporate Idol and Musar, the Ancient Jewish Philosophy for Personal Ethics, a Beginner's Guide. Let us begin with Dr. Greg Marcus. Shalom!
Shalom!
So, tell us, just as background, what is your Jewish faith? And you're a Reformed Jew at the moment. Were you raised that way?
Yes, I was raised in a Reform Jewish household, and then for a while, as a young adult, I attended conservative services, and then after I got married, my wife and I joined the Reform synagogue.
Now, for the lay person, and forgive me for using the word lay, but it does turn me on a little bit, what is kind of the difference between conservative Judaism and Reform Judaism?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of differences, and I'm certainly not, I would not claim to be an expert in this area, but conservative tends to be a bit more Hebrew-centric, and Reform takes the attitude that there's a lot of wisdom we've learned over the years, and Judaism is something that's constantly growing and reinventing itself. And conservative tends to be much closer to the traditional Orthodox practices.
Okay, fair enough. So you find yourself more drawn to Reform, now that you're married and stuff, than to the conservative, because it's a little more malleable, as it were?
Yeah, you can, there's a little bit of a attitude among some Reform Jews, and certainly among others, that Reform Judaism is some kind of Judaism light, where it's like, well, we just get rid of all the Hebrew, but the Torah scholarship and the spirituality in Reform Judaism is absolutely wonderful, and it's about continuing to learn how to practice and live by Judaism, but just updated for the modern world.
So basically, you still believe in Hashem, you still believe in the Torah. It's just now and then you can sneak a ham sandwich. Is basically
right. Well, you don't need to abide by the rituals and the traditions that developed through Orthodox Judaism, which are not necessarily enumerated specifically in the Torah. But, you know, if you have a ham sandwich, it's not the end of the world.
Oh, with bacon and cheese, too. Sometimes it's good.
Hey, you know, there's other things like foie gras or the mistreatment of, you know, eating veal because the cows are mistreated and making veal that you might say those should be a part of our
Our restrictions.
And because the spirit of it is about treating animals kindly.
Oh, that's nice. Now you've kind of done a very nice explanation of Reform versus conservative. But then there's this whole branch. I don't know if it's not a sect, it's not a branch per se, but what you have been studying and now writing a book about is something called Musar. Never heard of this. What the hell is it?
Well, Musar is a 1,000-year-old Jewish spiritual practice that was almost lost in the Holocaust. So it was very commonly practiced in Eastern European yeshivas. And what it does is it teaches us how to look inside inside ourselves and find those things that cause us to get in the same trouble over and over again. And then it offers a way to bring those things back into balance. So it's really, it's a practice of introspection, of character development, and everyday spirituality.
So I think it's starting in Lithuania, but it sounds really more Eastern than that. Was it a bunch of like Thai and Chinese and folks like that influencing Judaism with stuff that we would hear more likely from Buddhism or Baha'i?
We would, a lot of the things that I've learned in Buddhism, or Musar, sounds like things you would learn in Buddhism, but they are very Jewish. The roots go back to the 10th or 11th century.
Ooh.
Duties of the Heart, written in 11th century Spain. It's talking about meditating. It's talking about how to really live and internalize what might be taught in Torah, but instead of book learning it, it's about how do we live it and how do we do it in everyday life.
Well, you wouldn't think that would be controversial, but if you Google Musar, which I had to because I knew nothing about it, it'll say that the Orthodox had an issue with this discipline, I guess you would call it, because again, anything that pulls you away from Orthodoxy is seen as something that threatens Jewish life and continuation and culture. Is there anything in Musar that directly conflicts with, let's say, the serious Lubavitch Satmar Orthodox sects?
You know, the Orthodox, as I understand it, it's not a uniform movement by any stretch of the imagination. And one friend told me that he went and visited his brother who lives in Israel and a modern Orthodox community, and there's not one kosher section, there's five kosher sections in the market, because the different Orthodox communities can't agree on exactly the right kosher. So I'm sure it offends somebody. And traditionally, the Hasidim and the Chabad and Lubavitch have been a little bit distrustful of Musar for reasons that, to be completely honest, I don't completely understand. But this is a thoroughly Jewish practice.
Well,
and
yeah.
You know, you get two Jews in a room, you get three opinions, right?
So, I was going to make that same exact joke. I was saying, we are on the same wavelength, Greg Marcus, I can see that. But how do you study this? I mean, you can say to yourself, okay, I'm going to open myself to be more ethical or whatever, but how do you physically, what are the steps? What are you writing about? What have you read about in the books?
So the idea, so a couple foundational ideas. One is that we are all souls. It's not that we have a soul, but we are a soul. Okay, and everything that we do in the world is influenced by the state of our soul. Now, a soul, that's a real, they can go real esoteric, but what they do is they say, okay, well, we can't understand exactly what it is, but there are things called soul traits, which are little pieces of the soul. And those are things like humility.
I need to work on that one, okay.
Patience.
Like, I need to work on that one, too.
And so for each one, for something like patience, having too little patience is just as bad as having too much patience. So for 2 weeks, we will work on patience. Now, you might say, well, how can having too much patience be a bad thing?
Right, yeah.
I have too little patience, so I'm swearing at other drivers, and I'm, getting real hot and bothered when my kids can't get out the door fast enough. So, okay, I understand why being more patient is better, but if we're too patient, we might stay in a bad situation too long. Maybe we're in a bad job. Maybe we're in a bad relationship. And it comes a point where you can't just say, well, if I'm patient, things will get better. We need to take action. If there's social injustice, we can't sit around and be patient and hope that magically things will get better. We need to take action to make things better.
That's that is a marvelous explanation. Okay. What are some other aspects of Musar that need to be, you can hear them, but it doesn't really sink in. You have to work on them. You have to read more about them and explore.
Yes, this is very much a practice. So there's 13 different, they're soul traits. The Hebrew word is midot.
Soul trait, it's a love trait, it's a soul trait. Sorry, continue.
Yes, well, you get on and you play music and you dance and it's on TV and it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, not for the host. He killed himself later on. But anyway, He really did. It's kind of a sad thing. But
that is sad.
More about Musar.
So there are 13 soul traits. You practice each one for 2 weeks, and you start the day with a mantra, with something to kind of set your mind and to kind of prepare yourself to observe throughout the day how this soul trait is coming into play. So then during the day, you will look for opportunities to test yourself. So if you're doing patience, for example, it might be, okay, I'm going to seek out a long line to stand in. And I'm going to stand in this line and say, boy, this is a really good opportunity to practice patience.
Oh, interesting.
I'm going to allow other cars to move in front of me while I'm driving to practice patience.
Now, can I ask what something like that you did yourself, be it for patience or another one of the 13 mantra things? What's something you physically did in the past months or years to help yourself to get over a hump, as it were?
Right. Well, let's see. What is something that I did? So one thing, one of the soul traits is called honor, and that's like honoring other people. It's how you treat others.
Okay.
But one of the practices is you greet everyone before they can greet you. So you're walking down the street, and you see someone coming, and you give them a big smile, and you say hello. Now, that might seem like a small thing, but, you know, if you're in New York and you're going down the street and smiling at everybody and saying hello, I mean, back in the 70s, you could get shanked or something like that. So it's not something that we're used to doing, but each time we do that, it has an influence on our inner world, and we become just better at looking people in the eye and connecting with other people.
And would you even still recommend doing this on the subway?
You know, I think Judaism also puts a premium on life preservation. I think that people will need to judge their circumstances. I live in California now.
Ah, well.
You know, I don't have that. We don't have subways or those particular things. But even out here, it's not something that people regularly do.
Well, if you're on the freeway and somebody cuts you off and you start going, "Hi, hi, nice to see you," you're dead. The gun comes out, you're dead.
I would not be greeting somebody on the freeway like that. If somebody cuts me off, it's like, okay, whatever. I might feel a little compassion. Boy, they must be really having a bad day that they feel it's so necessary to do an unsafe maneuver like that to get wherever they're going more quickly.
Now, we're talking with Dr. Greg Marcus, and people say, "Ooh, doctor, and we explain, no, he's not a doctor that gives you shots or puts you on an operating table or anything like that. You have a doctor in a different thing, but you were kind of biomedical in a way. Your whole background, I had no idea about this, was in chemistry and biology, yes?
It was in molecular biology and genetics.
Genetics, wow.
Every time you say I'm not a doctor that gives people shots, I'm reminded of my grandmother, may she rest in peace. She used to say, is he a doctor, or a doctor, a dentist? And so be like, oh, he's a doctor, a dentist. Well, now be, oh, he's a doctor of philosophy. And she was, for the record, a little disappointed I did not go to medical school, being a good Jewish grandmother that she was.
Being a good Jew, that's just incredibly natural, but you were in the field. I mean, there are doctors who are, or non-doctor doctors, who teach English. You know, they teach history, things like that. You know, you go get them, you show them a boil on your neck, there's nothing they can do. They're useless. Absolutely useless. But you at least understand genetics and molecular things and how Watson and Crick do the helix stuff, I assume.
Oh, yeah. That was like my bread and butter. And I, for 10 years, I did research in genetics and human genetics, and I would see, I was in the biotech industry, and we would have these really cutting-edge devices for genetics research, and I would see a story in the New York Times about new genes discovered for schizophrenia, and that would be one of my customers, the scientist using my product.
See, this bothers me because I think all schizophrenics should wear slacks and not jeans, so you know, they should leave the new genes alone. I'm very sorry
about
shorts? That. Shorts, too.
What about shorts? What about corduroy shorts?
And although it's dangerous, they're falling around, they're psychotic, they're going to hit their knees on things. The knees have to be protected. So shorts, maybe not such a good idea.
You're right. I hadn't thought of that through sufficiently.
See? They should take away your doctorate. You need to take more classes.
Well, I don't have a doctorate in pants. Doctorate in jeans.
You're right. So wait a minute. A biotech company, what were you guys specifically looking for or trying to help or do as far as genetics? What was your research looking for?
Well, so there are some biotech companies that make medicines, and we were a biotech company that made machines. So we were created a device to let people look at a million different genetic markers at the same time. And it used to be you'd study 400 at a time. But if you could study a million genetic markers at a time, you know, that would be like going from having a map of, you know, a hand-drawn map of your city to having Google Maps, where you could find just about anything if you knew where to look.
What would you say? And not you yourself, but as part of the team, as part of the company that you were with. Was there ever a great breakthrough? Was there ever a machine that you invented that did something that found the beginnings of a cure to something? Anything like that?
You know, there were. There was something we did, which they used to do a study of a sudden infant death syndrome in an Amish community. And they found that one of the causes was a metabolic disorder. It had to do with what the babies were eating, and so they could actually change their diet and make it less likely that they would die of SIDS. So, you know, that was one very direct example.
And that is not something that could have been done before the age of computers that could run a million genomes and go through the markers and things like that, right?
That was not a study that they could have. That was a study that was done in a month that may have taken 5 years to do previously.
So, you have this job. You're working for this big, important biotech company that is doing important, powerful, helpful work to humanity. But there's a problem. Tell us about the problem. For you.
Well, the problem was that I really felt like I was doing this great stuff. I was getting paid a lot of money to change the world, okay, and save people's lives. But the problem was I ended up working 90 hours a week. I thought that I had these great goals, but I forgot the fact that just because the company was making products to help people didn't mean that everything the company asked me to do was going to help people. So if I had to, you know, was asked to write a 5-year product forecast, a very standard thing to do, it was not something to stay up all night doing. It was put some numbers on a spreadsheet. So I allowed this to take over my life, and it pushed out so many other things. So I was working 90 hours a week, and that impacted my health, it impacted my family relationships. And ultimately, I ended up doing a worse job at work because I was a tired, stressed-out wreck all the time.
Now, there's a story that you have on your website. You've got a really nice video there where you're talking about your life coaching and stuff and what led you to that. And you said, you know, you had been working and working and doing this day in, day out, and you were shepherding a project along, and you finally brought it to fruition after all these hours of getting no sleep and working on this thing, and it bombed, right?
It did. It flopped in every customer's hands, and what I thought was like a personal triumph became just like a terribly dark episode in my life, where I was blamed by everyone in the company for this product's failure, and I really blamed myself. And it got so bad that I really started feeling, you know, despite all the stuff that I had, I started feeling really worthless.
I want to stop you there for the moment. I'm just a little curious, what was that product trying to do?
So that was the product. So eventually we had this product with a million genetic markers. This was the product with 500,000 markers. So the first one was 10,000, then 100,000, then 500,000, and a million.
Now, were you rushed to deadline on this?
Well, we were. We were told it had to be out at a certain time, and, you know, that was not something that we had control over. And so I was leading this team, and I said, we're going to make this date. And we made the date because we worked weekends, we worked through vacations, and we did that for a year. But
again, was there a point when you would have considered at least just telling the higher-ups, let's hire a dozen more people for 3 months, or, you know, we cannot make this date and have a quality product. What stopped you from doing that?
You know, that's a really good question. And if I had it to do over again, I would have done things differently. But the reality was that this wasn't the only time the company did this. And so if I hadn't been willing to push for that, they probably would have gotten someone else who did. Mm. But for me, saying no never even entered my mind. I was blindly following orders. You know, I'm not proud to say that, but it's something that I called, which I call corporate idolatry. I made the company the most important thing in my life, and when they said, you have to do it, I just snapped and said, okay, we have to do it. I mean, I was so devoted. I wasn't like the guy drinking the Kool-Aid. I was the guy serving the Kool-Aid. I'm like, we have to do this, and there's people who are waiting on it, and our customers, they have important work to do. And well, that was what, you know, and I pushed myself, and I pushed other people.
Well, on that day, that deadline day, when you turned in the finished product, did you think that it was good, or did you know already sort of in your deep down that you didn't want to say, oh boy, this is, you know, a jerry-rigged monster here?
Well, we, when you go to launch a product, we had to go to a committee of people to explain the product launch. And so we had a long list of risks. And we said, well, this could happen and this could happen. And next to each one, we said, well, here's what we're going to do to manage that risk. So, yeah, that data was there, and everybody knew that. But, of course, we all were just kind of blindly jumping over a cliff. And so was I shocked that this happened? No, I wasn't completely shocked, but I was shocked at the reaction that everybody was so surprised.
Well, when you say that the customers didn't like it, it bombed, it failed, a customer would be a hospital, another lab? I mean, it's not as if my next-door neighbor was buying this to keep in her basement and tinker with it.
Yeah, the customers were like big pharmaceutical companies or like researchers at, you know, top universities, at MIT, at, you know, at Stanford, at University of New Mexico. I mean, these were, you know, there were customers all over the world. There were researchers in Germany.
So how did they figure out that it wasn't working properly? I mean, they put in a series of data and numbers and crunched them, and they're just... the results, I don't know. How do you know it wasn't right?
Well, so what they would do is they would have DNA samples from people with the disease. So a typical study, you might have 500 people that had the disease and 500 people that didn't have the disease. And so they would run individual tests on each of those 1,000 samples. And so we said, you're going to get 500,000 markers. But they would run it, and they would be getting 350,000 or 400,000. It just wasn't robust, and it would be some samples it would work okay and some samples it wouldn't. And we went ahead and we fixed all of that, and they all came out fine, and they were really happy in the end. But it was a very arduous multi-month process.
It's like Obamacare. The initial rollout was bungled and too soon. But if you looked at it later and you tweaked and fixed, you realize there's a lot good about it.
That is a great analogy. And if they had said, hey, look, you know what? We're not quite ready, so we're going to just have a couple people try it, and it's going to come out a month or two later, they would have been fine. Mm. It's almost exactly the same. People felt like they couldn't say no. They had to make this date. They kind of fooled themselves into thinking it would be okay, and then boom. You know, disaster.
Now, you're talking in retrospect here of someone who went through all this and was a workaholic. How long between this dark, dark time and then coming out of it and saying, you know what, there's more to life than this company?
Well, you know, it was about 6 weeks in. So this started around, you know, in the September-ish time frame, and things made a very dramatic turn on Yom Kippur that year. So it was about 6 or 8 weeks in, and I was in services, and I was fasting. It was 3 in the afternoon, and I just, you know, was chanting the Torah in the afternoon and all of this. And so I just glanced down at the translation, and these words jumped out at me: don't turn to idols or molten things. And so my first thought was really dismissive. It was like, oh, the old statue-worshipping thing, that has no relevance. And then this idea just popped into my head, said, you need to do what's best for the company. It was almost like somebody was talking in my ear. And I got really, you know, my stomach clenched, and I started sweating, because you need to do what's best for the company. That was the rationalization we used. It's like, we have to do what's best for the company and shift this product. We have to do what's best for the company and lay these people off. And doing what's best for the company is not the same as doing what's best.
Right, for the world or for you or for, you know, yeah, of course.
So, and I realized, oh my God, I've turned my company into a false idol. I've made it the most important thing. I wasn't following the values that I'd been raised with. I was following doing what's best for the company. And the more I researched this, then the more I learned on it. So I decided that day that I needed to start doing what was best for myself and for my family, and really getting back to, frankly, the Jewish values that I was raised with. And so within a year, I'd cut my hours by a third without changing jobs. And nobody at work noticed.
And that's just so funny. They were down on you for when you were working 90-hour weeks and trying and skipping vacations and all this. And then suddenly you started working a little less, you show up a little less, and then boom, boom, they're happy. They're happier with your work, and they're fine with you, you know?
It's like
people who think, oh, I'm going to show up at 7:30 so the boss knows I'm in early. And it's like, yeah, the boss has other things on his mind usually. They don't give a rats.
Or even if the boss thinks he wants that, you know, I wasn't tired, so I made fewer mistakes. I could be more creative. I was a better problem solver. And then I cut my hours by a third again the following year. So I was working less than 50 hours a week. And I had been successful previously, but my career really took off at that point.
And that's amazing. That's wonderful. You cut literally 40 hours off the weeks that you had been working. And there's a lovely story. There's a thing that once you had, now you were coming home, not at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, but you were coming home at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, and you saw, what, your daughter doing something?
Yes.
And that made you think of something? Tell.
Yeah, so I was walking by the living room, and I looked in, and my daughter was a toddler at the time, and she was playing with her friend. And it wasn't, they were very wild kids. It wasn't this wild, rambunctious play. They were sitting crisscross with their heads together, and they were whispering. And it was so sweet. And I realized, my goodness, if I had been at work, I would have missed this irreplaceable moment. And those are like the little things in life, you know, that if we're just rushing all the time, we miss just the most wonderful things that are going on around us every day.
And also, wonderful and tragic and terrible things, too. There was a moment during that shifting period from the dark time into moving away from being a workaholic where you experienced a death. And you were debating whether you could come or not to the funeral, right?
Yes, my grandmother died right at, I was at a conference where we had just launched the product and it was flopping, and I spent all day telling people that things were going to be okay and trying to save the business. And then my grandmother passed away. I was very close with her, and I was thinking about not going to the funeral because this work was so important to me. And, you know, thankfully they agreed to hold the funeral for a day, and I went, and that's not a very admirable thing, but at least I made it there. And if I hadn't, that would have been just something I would have felt bad about forever.
So already that was the ramping up towards where you are now. And you are still working for this company, are you?
No.
Oh, what happened?
I stayed with that company for about a year and a half after that. Then I left that company. I worked somewhere else for a couple of years where I was very much in balance. You know, I was working 40, 50 hours a week, and a lot of strange things that happened. Like, I would be told, you're the most productive person I've ever seen. You get more done than anyone I've ever met. But people kind of perceive you as a 9-to-5-er. What? I get more done. Why do you care how many hours I work? But I actually left the corporate world. I was working on a project that was very challenging. I was working with people who were assholes.
Good for you for...
And I said, you know, I don't need to do this. And so I resigned to figure out what to do, and I became a stay-at-home dad and wrote my book.
You became a stay-at... Wow. Wow. Now, to be fair, there are going to be people listening to this interview who aren't lucky enough or have not been lucky enough and have the background to be able to work for all those years, make a lot of money, and then come home and stay home. There are people who have to work minimum wage jobs or live two paychecks to the next two paychecks. How do you tell them, make sure there's balance, take it easy? How do you tell someone who has to work two or three jobs just to pay, you know, the rent?
That is a very different, that's a very different issue. That becomes an issue of survival. And for, you know, where I am in Silicon Valley, you'd think people were talking about survival when, you know, they have their six-figure, seven-figure salaries, and they're worried that, you know, if they don't work this long, something terrible is going to happen. Someone who's working three jobs just to survive, that's a social justice issue. And I would tell them to look for opportunities to unionize or to fight for a higher minimum wage or something along those lines, because there's no reason for someone to be working two minimum wage jobs and still being on food stamps. That's
what it is. You know, from health insurance,
terrible.
You know, it's horrible. It is. If people really could afford cars and sending their kids to college and keeping themselves healthy and to doctors, you need six figures in certain cities in America, including California and Silicon Valley, you know?
That's right. And there's actually been a big movement here where they've started to pay much higher wages to, like, the custodians and to the people who drive the shuttle buses in Silicon Valley.
Good.
You know, there's all this money that's flowing into the people who are making the products, but the people at the bottom were not sharing in that prosperity. So that's one of the positive changes that we've seen out here.
Well, that's California for you, and good for you. And thank goodness for that. You know, you're not going to find that in other cities, unfortunately. You know, they'll raise the minimum wage just enough to keep people slaves. And which brings us back to Passover, by the way, which it is. And so to kind of wrap up this conversation with Dr. Greg Marcus, do you have any great childhood memories of Passover?
Childhood memories of Passover. You know, we used to go to my grandparents for Passover, and you know, I just remember my grandfather, who was born in Romania, and he could go through that Seder so you know, so quickly. Just, you know, and you'd be like, hop, 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 okay, let's eat, and it was just always a lot of fun.
And do you hold two seders yourself? Do you go to other relatives? What do you do now in your life?
So now what we do is we have a very close group of friends, and we get together. One of them hosts a seder, and we get together and go there. And we have a great time. And another friend of ours wrote his own Haggadah in the style of Dr. Seuss.
Oh!
Read that every year, and we bring in sometimes the kids do skits, and it is just a lot of fun.
That is what it's all about. I wish... You know, I wish so much of all the different sects of Judaism would understand that it's about fun and family and tradition, but not going crazy with the traditions and being worried, oh, there's 18 different sets of dishes, and you have to do this, and you have to get every little crumb off the thing. It's not about all that. And you can become a holiday-holic if you get too into the minutiae. Of these things.
Exactly. You get into the minutiae and drive yourself crazy. And, you know, for some people that's you know, important to them. And okay, that's fine. But it's the rest of us shouldn't feel bad because we don't do that stuff. And if we're getting together with family, and there's a lot about Passover to like, about learning how to ask questions and not just accepting things the way they are and telling stories and, you know, remember the stranger because you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I mean, that's that's a foundational Jewish value that I think we all share. Even a lot of secular Jews, they fight for the underdog, and they don't even know why. Well, that's a Jewish thing. It goes back to Passover, remembering that you were strangers in the land of Egypt.
Wow. Well put. Now, you have written the book, as I mentioned at the top of this interview, Busting Your Corporate Idol, which is available in all the usual places books are sold. What about this new one, though, if people want to learn more about Musar, the Ancient Jewish Philosophy for Personal Ethics, A Beginner's Guide? Is that available yet?
That is not available yet.
Ah.
It is. I'm still writing that. That will be out in 2016.
Oh, okay.
But
people can read your blog, right?
People can read my blog if you go to drgregmarcus.com. You can read my blog. You can sign up for my email list. And I am part of a great group of people. We founded another website called BayAreaMusar.org, where we're trying to really create a big Musar community here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I really welcome people to get in touch with me, follow me on Twitter, go to my Facebook page, and I'd love to be in touch and see how I can help you in your secular and spiritual journey towards balance.
Because you do life coaching and things like that as well. You work with people, right?
Yeah, I work with people one-on-one, and people come to me who are just working all the time, and their personal life is suffering, and they've had enough, and they feel trapped and don't know what to do, and I can help. I've helped a lot of people where in just a couple of months, they're not working on weekends, and they're thriving in their career, and it's spectacular what people can do if they just learn to look at things a little bit differently and just try a few different techniques.
Sounds good to me. drgregmarcus.com. That is the website and the blog, and that'll take you to the Twitter and the Facebook as well. drgregmarcus.com. Last question for you, Doctor, and we thank you so much for being so much fun and so interesting on this program. Give us one more of the 13 things that Musar people need to think about and work on and develop.
Well, so one of the other traits is order. The Hebrew word is seder, which is also very relevant for Passover. So someone with too little order, like myself, will tend to be messy, and people with too much order will tend to be, obsessively fastidious. And so it's finding that right point of balance. So with Musar, it's not about becoming something you're not overnight. I would say, what is the one small thing that you can start to do? I'll share you a real funny story.
Please.
I decided that when I was first practicing order, what I was going to do is I'm going to start putting my pajamas under my pillow every night in the morning. Because at bedtime, I was stressed out, running around looking for my pajamas all the time. So I said, I'm going to put my pajamas under my pillow, and it's been great. I always know where they are. So I told this to my Musar teacher, and she said, that's really good. And plus, would God really leave his pajamas on the floor?
Well, God would, because he's God.
God doesn't even wear pajamas. We know God just goes in the buff.
Oh, my God. Wow. Wow, there's an image. Well, unless God is a woman, then who? There's an image. Lots to think about, thanks to Dr. Greg Marcus here in the neighborhood. Please go to his website, please check him out, and please bring some ethics and some balance into your life, for example, by listening to this radio show every Saturday morning. Dr. Marcus, thank you, thank you, thank you. A delight and a happy Pesach to you.
Happy Pesach. It's been an absolute pleasure.